Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. My special guest tonight is, again, Hans Krampe, who lives in British Columbia, Canada, but who lived in East and West Germany from 1943 until the 70s. Now, if you didn't hear last week's show with Hans, you should, and you can avail yourself of that in the VOR Heretics Hour archives. I'm going to bring Hans on right away this time. Hello, Hans.
Hello, Carolyn.
Well, I'm very glad to have you aboard again. You wrote an article published on March 3rd at the Radical Press, which people can find at www.radicalpress.com. And it's still up on the front page. It's called Dönitz and the American Brass. And your article is based on a book about Admiral Dönitz and the Nuremberg Tribunal, which, as a matter of fact, found him guilty of war crimes, which was a shocking and wrong thing to do. But tell us about this book, and tell us why you wrote the book, why you wrote the article, I mean, and what your article is about.
Well, prior to getting this book, I had the impression that the general population of the United States was utterly convinced that everything about the National Socialism and Adolf Hitler and the war was bad, and everything they did was good. And I didn't hear any dissenting voices other than from revisionists. And in my own research, I found that there was something entirely missing from the entire discourse, and that was the period between the First World War and the Second World War, which would have thrown an entirely different light on the historical discourse. Well, it was obvious that the International Tribunal was not dispensing justice, but was dispensing revenge and human rights abuse towards the defeated Germans. And all of a sudden, I come across this book, Dönitz at Nuremberg, a reappraisal. And it was a compilation of protests, expressions of protests and criticisms about the International Military Tribunal and its treatment of the flag officers there being tried.
I'm a little confused about just exactly what a flag officer is, Hans. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, the flag officers in any military are the most high-ranking officers there. They are usually generals, admirals, and they are called flag officers, whereas lower ranks are not called flag officers. They are just staff officers. That's the way I understand it.
Oh, okay. Well, so, sorry. Continue, please.
So here were these expressions from flag officers, over 400 of them. And I thought, 400? Now, in 1953, after Dönitz had spent 10 years incarcerated and was now released, all of a sudden they remember that, well, Dönitz was a flag officer too. And so possibly, you know, he was then considered a member of the same class of officers. There seemed to be some kind of fraternal loyalty to the same class of officers among staff officers. So these guys now started writing these 400 expressions of congratulations to Admiral Dönitz for having regained freedom, and how terrible it was that he had been condemned to jail, and how unjust and what kind of a stain it was on the reputation of professional soldiers, etc., etc. It started out with the letter by Admiral Dan...
Dan V. Gallery.
Gallery, yeah.
U.S. Rear Admiral.
Yeah. It was not only his staff officers that that sent these expressions in. It was also diplomats, royalty from other countries, staff officers from Chile, from Bolivia, from Greece, Italy, Britain even. Also, prominent personalities like writers and philosophers, etc. And then
even it says here the future U.S. President John F. Kennedy.
Well, John F. Kennedy was indirectly talking about it by describing how Representative Taft of Minnesota was campaigning, and he was disturbed by what happened at the IMT. And when he was disturbed, he would not mince words and speak out. And Kennedy kind of described this. In his statement, unspokenly suggesting that he actually agreed with Taft. So I thought, this is a bombshell. I have never heard that 400 high-ranking staff officers of the enemy forces actually found no wrong with what Admiral Dönitz had done or what the U-boat campaigns in the North Sea had done. It was perfectly acceptable the way the war was fought. And all of a sudden you had the International Military Tribunal creating ex post facto crimes by saying that the Germans had conspired to wage aggressive war, and that Dönitz and the U-boat commanders and crews had actually practiced aggressive war, and that they had offended the laws of the sea, which is an ancient, obscured law that had been applied to the windjammers, the tall ships in the 17th and 1800s. And so it was obviously dragged by the hair out of obscurity to find some means of sentencing the defeated German enemies. Then, you know, logic immediately raises the question, how can anyone fight anything but an aggressive war? War is aggression in its very basic nature. If there's a war, of course there is aggression. And hadn't the Allies not waged aggressive war?
Well that's, I thought when they used that term in those tribunals, aggressive war, and in those war crimes, that they meant by that Germany had started the war. That Germany was the aggressor, you know, in the beginning, and then they were just the defenders, which, of course, is totally upside down and backwards. But I thought that's what they meant by aggressive war.
Yeah, that's another point. I have, unfortunately, only in German language, listened to a YouTube presentation by a retired German general. I forgot now his name. I'm terrible with names. But he has written the book, The War Who Had Many Fathers.
Oh, yes. Yes, I know about that book.
Ronsdorf or something,
yes.
Was his last name. Schulze Ronsdorf,
yes,
think.
Yes, right.
And he researched this issue of who started the war thoroughly. And it turns out that at the outbreak of the war, Germany's armed forces were being outdone by numbers with the immediate neighbors like Czechoslovakia, Poland, Denmark, Belgium, France, etc., outnumbering the German armed forces at a ratio of 12 to 1. And Ronstorff just...
You mean all of those combined was 12 to 1?
Yeah.
France had much better preparation for war at the beginning than Germany did, and that was the major, major enemy.
The French had actually prepared to attack Germany and had already attacked Germany before, right after the First World War in 1923, I think, together with the Belgians, after Germany had disarmed in order to qualify for the League of Nations membership. They had invaded the Ruhr area and then commenced to rob Germany of its resources in the Ruhr area, the coal and the industrial productivity, the labor and everything. By actually abusing and beating up Germans on the street without provocation. And this
exactly right.
And that went on for several years. And Hitler made an end of it by rearming and rebuilding the Wehrmacht to a size that it was capable of defending itself. Well, that was then interpreted by the future Allies as him preparing for aggressive war and, with the intent to conquer the whole world. More or less.
Exactly right. That's exactly what they've done.
So, as to the allegation that Germany had started aggressive war, what preceded in 1939 the German invasion of Poland, which is a term that I find utterly questionable, because they didn't invade Poland. They invade German territory that had been illegally occupied by the Poles, including Danzig, including West Prussia, Pomerania, and the Russians still having occupied East Prussia. And under the Polish administration of the occupied territories, they had commenced wave after wave of criminal and human rights abusive activities in Poland, where they stole property from Germans, harassed them, murdered them, abused them, incarcerated them, etc. By 1939, these activities had kind of quieted down for a moment, like the silence before the storm. And as diplomatic efforts were taking place by Hitler to settle these territorial questions about the occupied territory by Poland and the city of Danzig, and trying to establish a corridor between Pomerania and East Prussia to have a connection to East Prussia, with supply lines by rail and road, etc. The Poles completely stonewalled every effort Hitler made to settle this issue in a peaceful and reasonable manner.
Right. And that's correct. Although let me bring up a technicality here, that according to the victors of World War One, Poles were not illegally occupying that territory, according to that which was the power structure and the League of Nations, I guess you would say. They were given that, and it was legally belonged to them. So, we can say from one point of view that it was illegally taken from Germany because it was wrongly taken. It wasn't right to take that land, but they only did it because Germany had lost and had once again laid down their arms. They hadn't surrendered unconditionally, but they'd been put in a position of now being unconditionally surrendered and had no power to do anything about what was taking place.
Well, that
was wrong, but I don't know if you could call it illegal, according to...
Carolyn, not by the wildest stretch of the imagination can you call this dismantling of Germany legal. you mustn't forget that Germany surrendered because it believed in the 14-point suggestion by Woodrow Wilson, the first and most important one being self-determination, and that the people inhabiting these regions were supposed to decide in referenda which country they would belong to. Poland had illegally, without any justification or any right, invaded German territory before it even came to a negotiation at Versailles and occupied that territory. It was completely illegally occupied, and Germany had every right to march in there and regain it for themselves. But then Hitler had actually granted the Poles, okay, you have occupied this territory.
That's
you
right.
You can stay there, yes. But allow us at least a corridor to East Prussia so we can have a live connection to East Prussia. And the Poles didn't want that.
That's right. Know? Now, this is what is totally irresponsible of the Poles. I have to say that. They keep trying to change that around and make that look different. But, you know, Hitler conceded a great deal that he didn't have to, because Germany was certainly capable of defeating Poland at that time. Poland was only able to stand firm because it felt it had the guarantee of more powerful nations on its side. But,
well,
but Hitler was giving all these concessions, and he only wanted the change in Danzig in the corridor. And they refused that because they wanted war. And so you're absolutely right. Even though they use aggressive war, saying that Hitler was was the aggressor, he was not.
Hitler was not the aggressor, and the Poles had already an expansionist policy in place. They were considered the entire territory to the Elbe River towards the west, including the city of Hamburg, as being a Polish territory, and that's where they want to go. And they were encouraged in this behind the scenes, undercover, by the British government, who constantly encouraged them not to get into peace negotiations or negotiate, but don't agree to anything, over years.
And not so many people say, and they document, that Roosevelt was behind the British doing that, saying
of
that.
Of course.
Roosevelt was the one who was pushing the British to push the Poles, not to negotiate.
Oh, by the way, I listened to your interview with Mr. Wesseler about Roosevelt and Churchill and these guys, and both of you weren't aware that Roosevelt is a Jew, that Churchill was a Jew, and that the people surrounding both of them, the ones with influence of money, were all Jews.
I am not convinced that either. Well, Churchill, supposedly his mother, yes, his mother, he was part.
Well, Churchill's
I'm not convinced about Roosevelt. I like to have really hard evidence, and I don't think it's that important.
Roosevelt's family originated from Amsterdam, and Amsterdam was a citadel, you might say, of Jewish predominance.
Yeah, but that still doesn't, that you can't make jump.
Anyway, but he was certainly very, agreeable to Jewish influence, you know,
yes.
Morgenthaler and all these kinds of guys. So, in 1939, all of a sudden, at the beginning of the German invasion, the Poles activated what turned out to be a secret plan that had been prepared and well organized. They labeled that plan as plan number 59 or 57. Carry out plan number 59 or 57. That was kind of a word that went around in the Polish occupied Germany at the time. The Germans were kept in the dark about this. As a result of that, it turned out to be a pogrom against Germans all over Poland. The most outstanding and bloodiest of them, probably Bromberg, the city of Bromberg was something like, in one day, over 5,000 people were gruesomely massacred in the streets. But before that already, there were so much aggressive activities and abuse happening to the Germans that Germans were as flocking across the border, despite being shot at if they were caught, into the German Reich in order to escape Polish aggression. And over 700,000 Polish Jews escaped before 1939 from Poland into the German Reich, and from the German Reich then further on into other countries. Now, you can imagine, here's the German Reich erecting emergency camps to catch all these Germans coming, flooding across the border in escape from Polish atrocities. And the German government was fully aware what was happening there, because they were, you know, they questioned these refugees and they heard what was going on in Poland, to the point where things, when Plan 57 was implemented by the Poles and all these massacres, you can't imagine the brutality and the sadistic manner in which the Poles fell upon all these Germans.
Yeah.
That was one of the reasons why Hitler invaded. You know, he couldn't delay anymore with peace, trying peaceful negotiations with the Poles, who obviously had no intention to be peaceful. In fact, they had announced many times over that they were going to invade Germany, and they expected to be in Berlin within a week. You know, this was expressed in a Polish newspaper, and another newspaper was describing that they were praying to God, that they were praying to the devil to support them in order to kill all these Germans, and that streams of blood would flow.
Hans, it's not too important what the newspapers say. What's important is what the diplomats are talking about, and diplomatically, the finger points to Poland as being...
Well, I'm trying to illustrate to listeners what the spirit was of the time in Poland. That was the important thing, not what the diplomats were saying. They were lying through their teeth while, behind the scenes preparing for aggression. And when Hitler then finally had no more choice but invaded Poland in order to relieve the... or protect the Germans that were still living there from Polish crimes. That was then construed as a welcome reason to declare war on Germany by England, by France, and here was the United States under Roosevelt making a big show of being still the neutral country and not taking sides in any way, while actually supporting the British in their war effort against Germany by giving them a fleet of 50 destroyers and doing aerial surveillance on U-boats and then giving the information to the British military, and by actually committing crimes of piracy by confiscating German ships, towing them into American harbors and arresting the German crews of it, all while they were officially pretending to be neutral. Now you tell me, who is the aggressor here? I don't think it was Germany. The Britain declared war.
You're absolutely right about all of that. You know, I'm not saying that's not correct, but I don't want to get too far off the track of what we were going to talk about in your article. We'll get back to it now after the break. So, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin a limited military action in Libya.
The question now on the minds of many, just how limited is limited? 3 days later in El Salvador, President Obama said this about the timeline.
I said at the outset that this was going to be a matter of days and not weeks.
But 5 days after that, here are two of the president's highest in charge, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, on ABC's This Week.
Do you think we'll be gone by the end of the year? Will the mission be over by the end of the year?
I don't think anybody knows the answer to that.
Though here's what NATO said shortly after taking charge of the operation.
What we have decided tonight is to take responsibility for enforcing the no-fly zone with the aim to protect the civilian population. The mandate doesn't go beyond that.
NATO's approved mission is for 90 days, with an option to be extended. So, what's the answer? Should we read deeply into the title, Operation Odyssey Dawn? Those in charge of naming it say it was totally random.
There was a group of planning officers led by a lieutenant colonel that sat down in the early days of planning and came up and looked at the list, and they decided to call it Odyssey just because they liked the sound of Odyssey.
Still, others find the name concerning.
It's sort of an odd combination of terms, and Odyssey implies that we're on a long journey, and dawn means we're at the beginning of that long journey, so in English, it's sort of a little worrisome.
And it's not just the dictionary definition to be concerned about. Think about Homer's epic, and I do mean epic poem, The Odyssey. It's basically about people wandering around the Mediterranean for 10 years, unable to find their way. From this book to the history books, the meaning of a limited war has been transformed time and time again. Here's President Bush talking about Iraq.
Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force.
Decisive force came and went, but the troops, well, they stayed.
How much longer can we expect this to go on for?
It'll go on until the regime is gone.
Saddam Hussein also went, and still, the troops stayed. Even when it seemed they may go. Here's President Clinton speaking about the need for the U.S. to get involved in Kosovo in 1999.
My fellow Americans, today our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces responsible for the brutality in Kosovo. We have acted with resolve for several reasons.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me is a very spirited and very interesting Hans Krampe, who we got off on a little bit on who started World War II, which is always interesting. But we're going to get back now to the Nuremberg and Karl Dönitz, and the way they did away with normal legal proceedings in order to carry out the kind of tribunal they wanted to do. So please continue, Hans, for us.
Well, in order to try Dönitz and Raeder and Jodl and all these guys that were sitting in the bench as defendees, they had to dispense with habeas corpus. The American attorneys simply dismissed habeas corpus and from the outset approached the trial with the attitude it was obvious that the Germans were guilty. Nothing needed to really be proved anymore. It was just a matter of dispensing sentences, death sentences, to deal with these horrific criminals. And here's the staff of the defense. I forgot now the exact number. They had something like 5,000 to 6,000 pages of material, documentary evidence who would rebut and disprove most of the allegations that the defendants were faced with. And here's the prosecution and the judge dismissing the entire evidence, looking through it for something that they could use, and then basing their entire judgment on something like less than 200 documents, which they had then, you know, picked with the fine tooth combs to suit their purposes. And yet, at the same time, they admitted massive amounts of completely ludicrous and unbelievable testimony from people who obviously hadn't even been there in the camps and were, you know, telling fairy tales of methods of mass killings that only an idiot could invent. And the Germans certainly weren't idiots, you know, like the killing in with diesel fumes in gas vans and gas chambers with Cyclone B pellets. Cyclone B pellets are a slow release kind of poison for safety reasons. It's designed to deal with pests, not with people. And that allegation has since been disproved with beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, well, we know that. Let's get back to how this trial was conducted more in the legal framework, rather than we know that the testimony was just terrible and ridiculous. But how does this affect Dönitz? And let's talk about how the military leaders were found guilty, because it wasn't, you mentioned Dönitz, Rader, and Jodl. You don't mention Keitel. He is another one. He was the chief of the Wehrmacht, and he's listed here. He's sitting here in the dock. You have some great pictures with this article. I hope everybody goes to the site, radicalpress.com, and reads it just to see the pictures. And then you were talking about how the American military or naval officials have reacted 10 years later and how they were too late.
Well, the legal aspect of the proceeding was totally fraught with illegality. There were what you call ex post facto creations of crimes. That means they accused the German leadership of being responsible for crimes that weren't even considered crimes before the outbreak and during the war. Before the outbreak of the war and during the confrontations during the war, and then after the war, they created artificial crimes in order to have something to accuse the Germans of. And what they accused the Germans of wasn't even coming close to what the Allies themselves had committed on the Germans, talking about genocide, talking about the mass bombing of the civilian population in Germany, flattening entire cities, abusing and murdering the POWs after the war. Now here you have, you know, a brilliant idea of how to kill a million people within a very short time, very cheaply, without having to construct elaborate technical facilities in order to do it. They simply put in barbed wire fences around a huge area, drove all these German prisoners of war into these enclosures, and let them die in there of starvation, of thirst, of their diseases, of exhaustion, exposed to the element, with no food, no medical care, anything.
Let me just say that before the trials started, well, in 1944, in the fall of in September 1944, we already have it on the timeline that this Colonel Murray Bernays, whose real name was Cohen, Murray Cohen, but he took his wife's name, so he would have a different name, the name Bernays. So Murray Cohen Bernays was appointed by the War Department to their special project branch. He was born in Europe, and he came to the United States, Jewish, of course, and now they are using, he's just typical of those people that they used to prosecute this and carry out the nasty parts of this horrible charade. And he came up, he was an attorney, he came up with the framework that was to be used, which was to treat the Nazi regime as a criminal plot. Everything that they did under Adolf Hitler was a criminal plot. This is what you are referring to in general when you say that they came up with these ex post facto laws, because it had never been a criminal plot in the history of the world to a country that was defeated in war were never accused of being criminals unless they had really done something. I don't think they ever were anyway. I'm not sure about that. But now they devised this idea that it was a crime, and everything that they did associated with it was criminal, and so they had 24 major war criminals and 7 organizations that were accused of being criminal, and they were all found guilty. Actually, 3 were acquitted. 3 of the 24 were acquitted, but all of the organizations were found guilty of being criminal organizations.
Yeah, including the organization of the SS especially. Wasn't Bernays a relative of Sigmund Freud?
No, he was by marriage. His wife was married, was a sister of the, she was a niece of Freud, yes.
He was somehow related.
So he was not truly related. That's why he took that name, though.
By marriage.
Her name, so he could be connected with Freud, yeah. And got all that. And of course, then it covered up his name of Cohen, so he didn't sound so Jewish. But he was one of the principal characters of this.
The hangman of the Nuremberg trial was Jewish. I forgot his name now. And he made sure that the condemned weren't hanged properly. He made sure that they were rather strangulated, or that when they fell, they would hit with their faces the edge of the trapdoor and then slowly died in agony, that kind of thing. Among the interrogators were many Jews who gruesomely tortured every one of these people that were sitting in the bench as defendants.
These major war criminals were not tortured quite as badly because they were too high profile, although they were mentally tortured.
But I don't think
they were tortured quite as badly as the lesser criminals, where they really did some terrible things to those who had
members of the officer corps of the SS and members of the SS. They were tortured. I read an account where something like 170 SS men were every one of them had their genitals trampled, and they were for life. And only 2 of them actually were not having that done to them. And among many other tortures. And when you look at Rudolf Höss, the former, one of the first commanders of the Auschwitz camp, he was tortured by laying in a room with bright lights on and 2 British soldiers with axe handles sitting there, and he had to keep his feet and hand from under the blanket, and whenever he moved or tried to fall asleep, they would beat him with these axe handles and make
sure
he...
They were British Jews, too.
I'm not sure, because...
when he was arrested, one of the people that was there at his side was Jewish. But anyway, let's get back to the admiral and the American brass, which is what the book was about, and how they came up 10 years later and tried to cover for what had happened by saying this has nothing to do with the military. We, you know, we don't want anything. We don't want our reputation stained by this travesty and so on.
Yeah. Well, these were a laudable sentiments that they came up with, but that still doesn't address or doesn't explain what motivates them, other than what motivated them to bomb all of Germany and its civilian population to smithereens. And the only explanation was given by Admiral Gallery, saying that the much maligned brass, meaning the flag officers, the high-ranking officers, the admirals, the generals, etc., having to do their duty, no matter whether it's in a democracy or in a dictatorship, without question asked, they have to obey orders. And that raises in me right away a whole bunch of questions. First of all, does that mean now that if you are a flag officer, you don't have to have, or you had to avoid having moral standards, having ethical concerns that you had to deal with yourself, and that you simply go like a robot and execute any order you get? And none of these guys who expressed their sympathies with Dönitz were ever talking about a huge crime and the biggest genocide in the history of the world. And not one word was mentioned about that. And that questions to me the value of their expressions altogether, because it's specious, it's a denial of their own crimes, but and still pretending to be decent people, which they aren't. They were
That's
mass
right.
murderers.
Well,
they were mass murderers.
Well, they don't want there.
I mean, let's not mince words. That's what they were. And the Germans were not. And despite the signatories to the Geneva Convention and the Hague rules on land warfare, they broke every rule in it, in the book, and committed massive crimes before, during, and after the war. And did they ever express any regret about that? No, they didn't.
Now, well, here's another thing they don't express regret about, and this bothers me, that Wilhelm Keitel, who was the chief of the Wehrmacht, and Alfred Jodl, who was his chief of operations, they were the two that worked closely with Adolf Hitler. They were the highest staff command. And they were hung. They were found guilty, and they were actually hung. And this is unheard of, and this is shocking and wrong. And Raeder was not hung. Raeder had some time.
Life imprisonment.
All those life sentences they didn't actually stay in for life, did they? Albert Speer was given, I don't know what he was given, I think he was given 20 years, and they didn't allow him out early, even though all kinds of people all over the world were putting forth petitions for him. He served every 20 years of that. So there's one example, but I don't want to get sidetracked into him. But these two noble and proper military commanders who didn't do anything, because they had made not only the SS a criminal organization, but I believe they made the Wehrmacht a criminal organization. And since they were the head of it, they were the head criminals. And, this is really terrible. And, you know, the German Republic of Germany, or whatever it was called then, maybe around the time...
Carolyn, this is the understatement of the year. I mean, they didn't just make the whole Wehrmacht a criminal organization. They made all of Germany a criminal organization.
Well, yeah, but not. They didn't actually say that. They didn't put that down.
For sure they said that. They have been saying this ever since.
They didn't have it down in law, but in the law, at trial, they had...
The law doesn't apply. The law didn't matter for these guys. They were going ahead and denazify Germany. What do you think that is? They considered all of Germany a Nazi hotbed that needs to be destroyed. And their entire intent before the war was to destroy Germany, not to destroy Hitler and the Nazis, Germany specifically.
We understand that, Hans, but we're trying to talk about this book and these issues that have come up here.
Well, these are all issues that tie into this, you know.
Yeah.
No, so, you know, ever since then, while Dönitz was still in jail, there was also Rudolf Hess, you know, the Chancellor of Germany, the second in command, who had flown to Britain with the intent to somehow sway the British royalty to impose, you know, or to stop the war. And word has it that Hess may have acted on behalf of Hitler, which could be and could not be. It can't be proven or disproven. But for that activity, for flying to England, trying to prevent the war, he was put in Spandau prison. Spandau prison was designed for 600 inmates, and he was there, the only inmate. The whole prison was empty, and he was there in solitary confinement for until the end of his life, until he was at age 87 strangulated.
He was age 93. It was in 1987 when he was murdered.
Yeah,
at the age of 93.
Oh, okay, at the age of 93, you are right. Yeah. I mean, imagine the injustice of that, a totally innocent man who had been well-meaning, trying to prevent the war.
Well, they would never consider him totally innocent because he was a Nazi, and he was a Nazi at the time the war started. So he's a part of the conspiracy to plot aggressive war, which is what the National Socialist Party was accused of, and he was one of them. So that's really, it wasn't because he flew to Britain, but when he did fly to Britain, they arrested him, and they kept him with no grounds to do so, actually. But they kept him for the rest of his life, so he wouldn't say anything.
Well, that's what I mean. He was not guilty by any moral or ethical standard. On the contrary, what he had in mind was laudable, and it was actually an act of bravery. And, to put him in jail for the rest of his life and then at an old age to murder him gruesomely, you know, by strangulation. What kind of people do that kind of thing? Some people who have been for a lifetime exposed to hate mongering, and that is the result of hate mongering that we are talking about. The IMT was the result of hate mongering.
That what they did to Hess was due to their spy network, their MI6 and so on, Secret Service, and they were in charge of that, and these people don't have any morals or any, and they're not following any code like that, and nobody even expects them to, because we all know they don't. So this is, when you get in their hands, this is at the top levels of government, that's the kind of thing that happens. So, you know, we're not talking about people who should be following church values or something.
Caroline, you misunderstand me there. What I'm talking about is the general attitude of the public who actually...
Yes, but that hate mongering was built up by these very people. It's not inherent in those people.
It doesn't matter what is inherent in these people. A continuous propaganda of hate has its effect on anybody, and the entire British population would have greeted this kind of activity or this behavior with approval because of a hate propaganda that had been going on for decades, for half a century and more. And so the population of Britain and the United States largely were primed to hate the Germans, and when they came over and waged war against Germany, they behaved accordingly, because rules of decency and compassion or those weren't applicable to people that they perceived as scum of the earth, and that's what the Germans were in their eyes. And that is a result of continuous, relentless hate propaganda. It's been going on, and it's still been going on today in a more subtle way.
I was just going to say, you know, it continues in Britain, in their newspapers, in their, but, so that's a good subject. How do we explain, or what do we have to say about how this hate propaganda continues and people don't wise up to it? Why aren't people wising up to this more than they do? This is one of the major problems that we face, because it's the people themselves who are so willing to believe whatever they're told.
It's easy to explain. If you are an elite that is entirely motivated by greed and selfishness, and you are in control of all the mainstream media, the movie industry, the publishing industry, and you have in mind to denazify an entire nation, and you brainwash the entire nation through their media system for half a century and more, you wind up with a population that is mentally ill. It's actually insane, driven insane by this relentless propaganda, inducing into the population of Germany, for example, a pervasive guilt complex.
Okay, let's say this here. Here's something interesting, Hans. You were brought up under Soviet brainwashing, and then you moved to West Germany, and you got into West German brainwashing, and you had a very difficult time ever changing your mind about all that. Now, I was born in the United States, and I was under whatever the kind of brainwashing we have here, and who would be worse off? I mean, I don't feel like I was insane or anything. I just didn't pay much attention to it. But what effect would you say it has on you? Because you're very passionate now, and obviously you have a lot of emotional feelings in the opposite direction as to what you were brought up with and believed for so many years.
Well, you know, once you start to realize you have been lied to and you had believed the lies, and your entire belief system and historical knowledge was based on 180-degree twists of historical reality, once you realize that, there is, of course, a sense of outrage. How could they have done this to us? And the reasons why I was able to get out of this and realize my own brainwashing was because of the information that was all of a sudden available to me in certain books, on the internet largely, you know, increasingly on the internet in the last 10 years, and it has changed my life practically. All of a sudden I see what really happened and to what extent I had been wrong for most of my life.
And apart from being wrong, do you feel that you have anger at being robbed? Or at being abused, or, you know, can you recognize feelings like that?
No, but I have a sense of responsibility. A sense of responsibility has grown inside me, that I have for all these people that have been tortured and murdered, all these German people, all these women and children who have been murdered by the Allies, and certainly my attitude towards Britain, towards the United States, towards Canada, and the Soviet Union, and the Poles, and the Jews, has completely changed. You know, all of a sudden I see them for what they were and for what they have done, and I see how they behave today, and how they behave today, and the insolence of that. That creates a sense of anger in me. You know, and I oppose it with all my mind, and I want the truth to come out and be told and publicly known.
Thank you, Hans. That's a very good way to end it. I'm pleased that we ended on this note, and I thank you very much for being on today. We will do this again. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.